This is the Plant Fueled Podcast. My name is Cass Warbeck. I'm a doctor, plant-based athlete, and vegan lifestyle advocate. This podcast is all about sharing conversations that will elevate your performance and your health. My guest today is Dr. Carla Edwards, a psychiatrist whose practice focuses on the diagnosis and treatment of mental illness and psychological struggles in athletes. I'll admit that before I really started digging into this, I didn't realize that sports psychiatry was a field all of its own. Just to clarify, this is different from sports psychology. Psychiatry involves diagnosing and treating mental illnesses such as depression, anxiety, and ADHD. We discussed these differences early on in our conversation. So within her approach to these conditions, Dr. Edwards must also consider athletic performance and consider sport-specific factors unique to each athlete. Dr. Edwards completed her medical degree in Newfoundland and her psychiatry residency at McMaster University in Ontario. She has worked with a wide range of athletes, including Olympians and elite athletes from Hockey Canada, Skate Canada, Swimming Canada, and Cycling Canada. She also provides psychiatry consultation to the Hamilton Tiger Cats and Hamilton Forge. She is president of the International Society for Sport Psychiatry and on the board of directors for the Canadian Academy of Sport and Exercise Medicine. And probably not surprisingly, Dr. Edwards is an exceptional athlete herself. Throughout her years of education, she trained in numerous sports, including basketball, softball, touch football, badminton, hockey, and kickboxing. But volleyball was where she really dominated. She has won multiple athletic awards, all while continuing to excel academically, and was introduced into the Newfoundland and Labrador Sport Hall of Fame in 2015. In our conversation, we discuss Carla's personal experiences within sport and the opportunities this provided for her, common mental health concerns in athletes, sport-specific considerations for diagnosing and treatment of mental illnesses, the pervasive stigma within sport regarding mental health, and so much more. Please enjoy.
Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Edwards. I really, really appreciate you taking the time out of your weekend to talk to me today.
You know, it's always great to meet with people like yourself who are interested in this field. And to be honest, I could sit and talk about sport mental health all day long because I think it's such a great topic and a topic that more people need to learn about. And I want to congratulate you on your podcast and the way that you're able to reach so many people. And I appreciate being here today.
Yeah, no, I'm so excited. I have so many questions to ask you. But before we kind of dive into the whole realm of sports psychiatry, I would just love to hear a little bit about your own athletic pursuits. I understand you are quite an athlete, and could you just maybe share like some of the sports you've competed in? I was reading online, like the list is so long.
Sure. I think I've been very lucky to have sport as the core part of my life throughout my childhood. My father was a teacher, so we took every opportunity to go to the gym when he was at the school preparing for his classes. My brother and I grew up essentially in the gym, on the field. He was a coach as well, so we were immersed in sport right from an early age. So we understood the importance of it and had access to it from then on. So it's truly been a normal part of my life and a routine part of my life since then. And then it just truly opened doors, clearly, where I had opportunities to travel and meet more people and find success. And those successes build things like self-esteem and opportunities and networking and exposures and, you know, the ability to, volleyball and basketball were my early kind of gold nuggets for me and opened doors to, you know, training for Canada Games. I was the youngest member of our provincial team to go to Canada Games back in 89, a long time ago. But then meeting a lot of people that are still sort of in my life in lots of different ways in the sport world. But again, you know, exposing me to new places and people, playing with people who are older than me, more experienced than me, that gave me really key lessons for learning on the court or in life. And those things, you just incorporate them like a sponge throughout your life. And it just, again, becomes part of your main MO as you go through. So certainly through high school, volleyball became my biggest sport. And the group of us who grew up together in a very small town in Newfoundland, you know, a town of 10,000 people, if you think about the feeder systems into our sport, it was really our school. And we had denominational school system at that time. So all of us were together in the Catholic school. And so it was just us. We were the same team for basketball, for volleyball, for a lot of things. But it gave us an opportunity to grow and as together as a group. And we had a fantastic coach who I really credit for a lot of the foundational elements of sport that I learned. But we grew together as a group, you know, being successful at the midget level, the bantam level, the juvenile level, the high school, you know, provincial championships. We just grew together with the opportunities and with the success. And those were certainly the early days, and that opened doors for university, you know, and then going, being scouted and playing at Mount Allison for 5 years, where I did a couple of degrees there again, and being surrounded by incredible people who were very inspirational and I learned a lot from. And then from there, you know, going through the medical system and still finding ways, though, to keep sport a part of that. So during med school, still playing, you know, and getting into, there's a lot of great athletes who are just beyond the university years, but still competing, right, in volleyball, basketball, football, softball. I was able to coach through med school, coach volleyball and basketball in high school. And then, you know, through residency, just sport finds opportunities. You move to a different community, you find an instant family and community in the sport, in that system. So again, learning that, having your roots in sport and then allowing that to open your doors no matter where you go, no matter what you're doing, has really been helpful for me. So now fast forward to this point in my career, I no longer play volleyball or basketball except in my driveway, but I play ice hockey. So I started to play ice hockey when I moved to Ontario, and I have a great community of people there. So the sport may have changed over the years, but the love for it and the love for what sport brings has never left.
So amazing. I can relate to many aspects of that. And I just have to draw attention to the fact that you competed at high levels throughout, like undergraduate, medical school, residency. Like, I feel people that aren't going through it don't understand how hard that is. And to not only like competing recreationally, making time for it is one thing, but actually compete at like a higher level is another thing altogether. Do you have any, I guess, like advice for how you were able to manage like medical school residency while like putting appropriate time into your training?
For me, it really went hand in hand. I think most young athletes and student athletes learn a way to balance everything, and it really goes synergistically. You know, that's a really important word in my life, synergy, where things going together actually or have a bigger outcome than some of the individual pieces. So for me to be healthy and feel good and perform well in anything, I needed all of those ingredients at all times. So the message that I give to a lot of students that I support is, you know, as you go into, whether it's your undergrad or medical school or your grad studies or whatever you're doing, don't assume that you need to give things up to make it work. In fact, you might need those other things to help you to be more successful at that, because you're used to a certain schedule. You're used to the need to budget your time, and you need those outlets. And sport is a fantastic outlet for a lot of things. So I find that the folks who do only one thing or create their pies of their wedges of activity in such a heavy level for one thing actually don't do as well. And a lot of the pro or elite athletes that I support, you know, if they're mostly just training, competing, and then, you know, eating on the other side of things, and it's really unbalanced. And it's that total balance that actually helps you perform better and can help you figure it out, because you learn the discipline early, and there's no need to abandon any of those things along the way.
Yeah. I've definitely like really tried to my sports. I don't know if you know, I'm very into like Muay Thai and kickboxing, jiu-jitsu, MMA. And
very therapeutic stuff.
Yes. I feel like I definitely wouldn't be as sane and the person I am now if I didn't go through those experiences and I hadn't had the opportunity to train. You just, again, need an outlet and something to almost like medicine shouldn't be your entire life.
No, but the sports that you discussed there are actually some of the most, the sports that are most identified as helping from a mental health point of view, because it requires planning, coordination, muscle movement, muscle planning, and being able to engage your brain in such a way. And in fact, that physical exertion, that direct muscle feedback, the tension, the resistance that you do and all the moves that you do, like those are outstanding sport in actually helping support your mental health overall.
Yeah. I think that's one of the things I love most about it. It's not one dimensional. You need like aspects of everything to excel in it. I read in your bio that you have done some kickboxing. I wanted to ask you about that.
That was therapy. Yeah, that was something that, again, throughout my life at various stages, I tried to just explore new things because as my life changed, I had different needs and different time frames to be able to do things. So I think I started out with that as a boot camp after I had my second son. So, you know, I was recovering from that, but I needed a way to get back in shape. And this was in my, you know, my town here in Waterdown, Ontario. And my friend and I decided to go, and I loved it. And it just engaged with, again, all the aspects of sport, that the ingredients that were so important to me that drove me throughout my entire career. Things like challenge. So you're competing against yourself, right? And you know, you have your own standards around how well you want to do. There's not going to be a score at the end of the day. You're not competing against a team necessarily, but man, I want to do more sit-ups, push-ups. I want to kick harder. I want to, you know, survive that circuit with more gas in the tank the next week. So it really provided opportunities to do different things with different people, but really you still have a great sweat. You have an opportunity to use all your muscles and use your brain differently, right? So you're engaging your body and your brain differently to create different challenges. And I think that's the message I try to give folks who are transitioning from aspect to aspect in their life, from stage to stage. You just need to redefine the relationship you have with sport differently. And you can find a whole different sport that you never knew before that could just open up doors and get your juices flowing in a way that is so therapeutic and so fulfilling. So I stayed in that for a long time, met some great people. And in fact, all the women in the kickboxing classes that I went to were so happy at the end of their classes. It was truly a form of therapy for everybody. And the pandemic got in the way a little bit of that, but certainly was very fulfilling for me.
That's so awesome. I love that. And I need to just step back for a second and draw attention to, I think this is so cool, and I just wanted to make sure that we talk about it, is that you were actually inducted into the Newfoundland and Labrador Sports Hall of Fame in 2015. And that is a phenomenal accomplishment. And I can only imagine this was a pretty surreal moment for you. Would this have, like, I would just love to hear, like, I guess what this was like, and then maybe share one of, like, the highlights of, like, your sporting career, one of, like, your favorite memories.
Yeah, that was truly incredible. I was so honored and privileged by that. In fact, it's great timing to talk about it. They had their Hall of Fame induction ceremony last night for the new group this year. It's just such an amazing privilege and honor to be honored with such great athletes and builders. And what's really cool, my grandfather's also in the Newfoundland Labrador Sport Hall of Fame. So being in there with him was phenomenal. And, you know, back in those days, the families were all very large. So my father's family had like 15 boys and they were all part of the same team. And a lot of them are, my uncle, I think, is also in there as a builder. So it's cool to be in there with my family. But I think Sport Newfoundland is doing a great job really trying to boost, you know, the messages that they give. I'm actually going down there in November to help them host a sports summit on safe sport. So really trying to build messages around how to help athletes' experiences be better and how to improve, you know, the delivery of sport overall. But I think, again, thinking back to opportunities when I was younger, I mean, we're on an island out there and people have varying ideas about different parts of the country, but there was great sport out there, you know, and there were hot spots where we had our rivalries and there was a lot of traveling. Every weekend we were on the road. But again, as a group, we stayed together, right, from grade eight right through until the time that we graduated. So all of those experiences were really important. And just experiencing the successes together, experiencing the adversities together. And I'll never forget our first 4A, you know, volleyball championship that we won in grade 11. We were playing against the big teams from St. John's, you know, where there's like hundreds more students to choose from. And, you know, they're powerful and big, big names and such. But for us to come in there with a small town and actually beat them and then and win it again for grade 12 was just, it was just outstanding. And it's a long time ago, but I think, you know, all of those experiences really create foundations for the next step, you know. And when I speak with athletes now, whatever level they're on, what I tell them is, it's really important to consolidate your successes each step as you go along the way, because those never change. If you internalize and remember and consolidate all of those successes, your highlight reels, everything that's great and positive about that experience, you don't ever have to go back there and you never lose that. So then you go on to the next challenge where you try to consolidate those successes, you make new goals, and then you go on to the next one. Never forget about those early days because those are extremely important.
That's very valuable. Thank you for sharing that. I'd love to, I think we should dive into a little bit more of the sports psychiatry. I guess first I'm wondering though, is I understand that after you completed residency, you practiced as a general psychiatrist for like several years. And then when did you realize or that you could focus your practice in on sports psychiatry and athletes, or was this kind of the goal all along?
It was never the goal all along because I didn't know it existed. I have to say, really. And, you know, again, sport was always part of my life and I loved it. But it wasn't until 2003, I was at a conference down in San Diego, I believe, for the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. And at that was a workshop for the International Society for Sports Psychiatry. And I had never heard of this entity before, but I thought, wow, that is really cool. What is that? And I went, and it was an amazing, I think it was a life-changing experience for me. It was a group of people who were together, who some of them had, been working as sports psychiatrists for many years, who were legitimate psychiatrists who were working with athletes almost exclusively and working with professional teams. And some were psychiatrists who had kids who were in sports and they wanted to learn more about it. But the theme overall was athlete mental health, across the ages. And they brought some really key speakers on, you know, substance abuse and performance enhancing drugs and mood and anxiety in sport. It was honestly TSN turning point for me. I was like, this thing exists. I want to do this. How do I do this? And, you know, coming from Canada, there was nobody in Canada doing this. So I thought, I want to do this and I'm going to do this. I'm going to find a way to do this. So that was in my third year of residency. And over the next couple of years of my residency, I found opportunities to do that. So when I was doing psychotherapy modules and I needed to find patients to work with, I found athletes to work with. So then I started to get more experience and understanding of, you know, the common challenges that they experienced and ways to intervene and understanding the systems. And that just grew it more and more. I just wanted to do that. But you're right. After residency, there's bread and butter psychiatry. That's the system here. So which was fine because, again, it's all learning opportunities and all skills and knowledge that you use forever. So I worked for 7 years at the Homewood Health Center, which is a private health facility, private public health facility in Guelph, which was great. I had some great opportunities to, again, meet, work with some fantastic individuals, grow my skills, grow my bread and butter skills. And I had a chance there also to work with some professional athletes and other athletes who happen to be admitted. Yes, they get sick too, right? So they also need to be in the hospital. So sought out opportunities to do that. And then after 7 years there, moved into the outpatient world because I had my first child and needed to have a more flexible schedule, and then did some child adolescent psychiatry. But at that point also started my sports psychiatry practice at McMaster. We had an athletic director there at the time who was very open to it and understood the importance of mental health for their athletes. And at the time, there were a few of their high profile athletes who had run into significant difficulties in a very public way with their mental health. So they wanted to develop a program in-house that would support the athletes because they felt more comfortable dealing with it in the athletic center versus, you know, going in the main student center and sitting amongst everybody who knew them, you know, as gods or whatever on campus, and they were less likely to follow up. So we created it in-house and grew that over the next few years. And it was really a fantastic opportunity, again, to grow my practice, to grow my understanding. I learned a lot from the athletes. I learned a lot about the system. And then over the next few years, I had opportunities to meet more people, right? Different universities working on different projects, going to different summits, expanding the network, and then other things opened up. So it was like the universe was unfolding throughout this time. And then, you know, Swimming Canada wanted to hire me to work with them because they had a few athletes who were quite ill and at Cycling Canada. So the doors just kept opening and this road just kept unfolding and it was incredible. But along the way, I wanted to build it. I still wanted to build this, not just about me. So I really want to build this across the country. So I started to meet people again through social media or different opportunities, psychiatrists around the country who were interested in this too. So let's do it. So since then, you know, I've been meeting with this group, growing it since, gosh, about 2016 now. And now we have someone in almost every province. And I'm really happy to say it's growing.
Yeah, it's so exciting. But I can see it's obviously still a growing field, as I had very limited knowledge. I didn't actually know it was a specific field within psychiatry. Like, and going through, I've gone through medical school, I'm in my residency, and it has never like crossed my radar. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited to share more about this because I think it's so important. And as you say, like, athletes get sick too. Like, they're regular people. They're not these warriors, these invincible people that I feel like they're made out to be sometimes.
That's right. And you know, yeah. One of the things that really struck me during my early residency years before I actually got in the pathway was noticing through the regular training, you know, regular hospital system, there were athletes who were either inpatients or outpatients for a variety of reasons, if the treating team or the assessing team weren't aware of or didn't have a knowledge base on sport itself or the role of sport in that person's life, there was a lot that was missed. Sometimes diagnoses were missed. Sometimes, you know, there was a missed opportunity to include sport into their treatment plan. So I'll give you a couple of examples. One was a wrestler who was admitted for an eating disorder. Well, we know in sport, wrestling is, you know, very much associated with weight-based, and there's a lot of weight cutting, and it's a part of the culture. It's a part of the sport, but they didn't have that lens. So they just thought it was all an eating disorder and was approaching it that way. And so I had an opportunity to help them understand that a little bit, and I think helped move along the treatment plan and support system in a different way afterwards. There was another young athlete, a 12-year-old female soccer player who was referred for gender dysphoria at the time. The young athlete was expressing their desire to become a boy. And the parents were quite concerned. They didn't understand what it was, but just talking to the athlete, she said very clearly, "I don't really want to be a boy. I just want to play high performance sports. And right now that's only on the boys' side of things. So this is why I want to be a boy." So lots of different, interpretations of things that can go in different ways, but understanding the whole sports side of things can really open up different lenses, opportunities. And I think it's an important nuance to understand.
Yeah, definitely. There's so many individual factors and not like just athletes versus non-athletes within specific sports, as you mentioned. And I want to get into that a little bit more, but I thought maybe we should just quickly define a couple terms, just because there is still so much confusion between sports psychiatry versus sports psychology. I think most people are familiar with psychology. And could you just speak to these differences just like real briefly, just so everyone is clear and on the same page?
That's a great question. It's a question I get quite a bit. And I think it's really important to understand the differences. There are a fair number of differences. Starting with our training, the type of training is very, very different. So for a psychiatrist, you get your degree, you go to medical school, you get your medical degree, and then you do psychiatry residency training, and then you become a psychiatrist. Now, in terms of sports psychiatry specifically, there's no fellowship in sports psychiatry yet, but there is an opportunity to obtain a certificate of additional training in sports psychiatry through the International Society for Sports Psychiatry, if you're a member of that. So there is an opportunity to get some additional training, some recognition for enhanced knowledge base and approach and the work that you're doing in sports psychiatry. Psychology, different degree programming. There's different psychology degrees. There's arts-based, there's science-based. And then they also have residency or internship programs. They can become clinical psychologists, psychometrists, other types of psychologists. In Canada, there's no sports psychologists necessarily. You have psychologists who have special training or interest in sports, but a little bit of a different pathway. And the psychologists in our country aren't able to prescribe yet, or do medical diagnostics. And I think there's just a different framework of approach to assessing and managing folks. Whereas psychiatrists with our medical background have more of a biopsychosocial approach where we can consider any potential medical contributors to how a person's presenting. We can order diagnostic tests. We can order lab investigations. We can prescribe. We can also do psychotherapy. So there's really a broad array of things that we can do here. Now, in the States, I know that there are some states that are exploring psychologists being able to prescribe, and they also have sports psychologists there. So there's going to be some changes in the landscape in the States in the next few years, but certainly in Canada, those are the main differences. In addition to how it's paid for. So psychiatrists, because we're part of the medical system, are covered by provincial health insurance. So patients, athletes don't need to pay for our services. It's free as long as we get a referral from somebody, whereas psychologists are covered to a certain extent by some benefit plans, and without benefits, patients pay out of pocket.
Yeah, no, those are huge. Thank you for explaining that so clearly. And I think that's probably one of the frustrating things. I feel like psychologists should be covered by provincial healthcare too, but that's a different conversation. Can I hear a little bit about your current practice, and then maybe we can talk about some of the common psychiatric disorders that you see within athletes. Your current practice or your clinic in Ontario, is this the Synergy Sport and Mental Health?
Wear a lot of hats.
Yeah.
Which is okay. A lot of fun.
So you have multiple things going on. I'd love to hear an overview.
Yeah, the Synergy Sport Plus Mental Health is a private practice that I started back in 2016 when I just really took the plunge and wanted to do this almost full time, right? It was kind of a scary point in my career because you never quite know, am I going to be busy enough? I know that I've been busy in different settings when I've been embedded in, you know, the sport med clinics at McMaster and Guelph. I know I've been busy there, but is it enough to sustain a full, you know, practice? And the reason I decided to do private practice is because I wanted to be unencumbered by external people telling me how long I should see people for and, you know, which people I should see. I feel that at my stage of my career, I understand, you know, when people need to be seen and how long they need to be seen for. So this provided me the opportunity to do that. So I'm able to accept patients from all, you know, ages, from youth right up to master's athletes. You know, most of my practice is focused on those who are, you know, where sport is a main part of their life. And you know, sometimes life has gotten in the way of sport. And so they come with bread and butter psychiatry challenges, or sometimes they're sent for sport-related anxiety, for example, which we'll talk about in a minute, but it turns into bread and butter psychiatry. So I'm still using all of my skills that I've accrued along the way, but it's in a way that it's in a setting actually that I created to be more comfortable. So what was really important to me in creating a private practice was I wanted a space that it was encompassed activity. So I have a punching bag in my office. I have treadmills in my office. I have yoga balls and TRXs and free weights in my office, because we know movement and activity and the sports setting helps open doors. It breaks the ice. It's a more comfortable setting for all of us. So I love it. It's just a nice energy space for me. And that was really important to me. So that's my site in Guelph. But just this year, I started going to the Toronto Rock Athletic Center once a week, where I'm in a lacrosse setting. So it's so cool. So it's an indoor lacrosse facility where I have an office. So I see people from the community and the Rock and other sports there. And during football season, I go down to Ticat Stadium and I see the guys down there once a week. So I have an amazing room overlooking the stadium there. So it's just, I love my job because I get to do it in such really cool places. And since the pandemic, I also still do a little bit online so that I'm able to also support athletes from across Ontario. I literally get referrals from all the schools, all the youth sports schools across Ontario. So supporting varsity athletes across the board and youths as well. So that's sort of the sports stuff that I do, but also I get to work with the National Ballet of Canada as well. So since December, really working with them and supporting the dancers who are off for injuries, you know, stress fractures and such are quite common, but also now having the opportunity to build a better mental health screening program and to deliver better mental health supports to the performers overall. So many opportunities. So that's the clinical practice, but also I serve on a lot of different boards and leaders in different organizations. So lots of different hats.
So much variety. I love it. But I think that's part of, like, I'm hoping to have a practice similar to that myself, because otherwise, I don't know, you just stay excited and you're involved in so many different things and you're working with different populations. This might be an unfair question, but do you have a specific, like, group of athletes you enjoy working with the most? Like, what gets you most excited?
You know, I chuckle to myself because, you know, every football season I get really fired up. Every time I drive away from Ticat Stadium, I go, oh my God, I love this work. I love meeting with the guys. I love working with them on all the stuff, whether it's performance or their lives or both of it together, working with the coaches. I just love, and being in that environment, I love it. However, but then I go to the Rock Center and I drive away from there going, oh my God, I love this work. Or, you know, when I'm working with the ballet dancers and I get to go and watch a performance and see the people on the stage that I'm working with, I'm like, oh my God, I love this stuff. And I chuckle at myself because I say it so many times, but I think it all goes back to the transition that I made in 2016 to create my own practice environment with this group of folks. That again was pivotal for me in the hugest difference in my work-life satisfaction. I love it all, honestly. I love it all, because if I didn't, I wouldn't do it anymore. And I think that's why, as my career has changed a little bit over the years, I stopped doing different pieces when it stopped feeling good and when that started to spill over into my life. So again, with the beauty of medical care in Canada is you have more opportunity to fill the gaps. And I was able to do that. And my practice right now with all the different things is filling a lot of gaps, and it's so very satisfying.
I love it. I can hear it in your voice. I love this. So, okay, what are, I guess, broad question, but what are some of the most common, like chief complaints or presenting complaints or concerns that you see in the athletes that you work with? And maybe it's sport specific, or maybe there's just like one unifying, like overall that you comes to top of mind, but I'd love to hear about your thoughts on this. And then I'd like to ask about a couple specific disorders, and maybe we can just go from there.
That's a great question. I would say the top two would be anxiety and depression. Sure. Anxiety is sometimes presented in the sport context, but you know, when you dig, it's often related to other things as well. So you know, one of the things that I really try to follow, it's really important to me, and I teach my students, is you need to understand the root causes for everything. If you only treat a symptom that's presenting in front of you, you're going to miss the big picture, and it's not going to be any better. So we have, again, as psychiatrists, we have the benefit of having the medical background, be able to really dig and find the root causes and really target those. So, yeah, I think anxiety is a big one. Depression is another one. Insomnia, sleep issues, goes along with both, but can be a thing all on its own. And unfortunately, maltreatment is a really big one too. And it's something that's so big that I screen all of the athletes that I meet with for that. I always explore their experiences, not only in the sport present, but also their sport past to see, because again, that can be a root cause for anything that's presenting at any time.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe touching back to the anxiety piece, anxiety and depression, I can ask the same question for both, but is the prevalence among athletes versus non-athletes about the same? Like, do you think there's a similar number of people that do sport and have depression, or do sport and also have anxiety as the general population?
The studies would tell you that, for sure. They would tell you that. I think the contexts are potentially different. We know that in depression specifically, that there are very specific things that can contribute to that, including, you know, the pressures of sponsorship. The U.S. right now, the NCAA athletes are dealing with the NIL issue, which is the name, image and likeness, which adds a whole other component that they never had before, which is, you know, they are having pressure to get paid for it. If anybody takes their picture and posts it anywhere, then they need to be attached to a company that's going to pay them for that. There's just so many layers that can be on top of sports that the average spectator doesn't necessarily understand or appreciate, because we just watch the sport and we love it. But that athlete is also going through financial pressures, being away from their family, traveling every other weekend, pressure of success, the pressure of repeating success, post-games crash. Anytime there's a big, either an Olympic Games or a championship, end of season, there's always a cliff that they drop off that we need to be aware of, because their life changes significantly after those events. There's a build-up. They spend so much time and effort really working towards things. And then the life can change on a dime, including after injuries, trying to come back after injuries, all of these components that are very much sport related that can impact mood that we need to watch for.
Yeah, I can imagine it being very challenging too. And I guess this is why it's beneficial that you have as much time as you need to talk with these athletes, because I can imagine teasing some of these things out must be very difficult. And even just like the overlap between depression, I'd imagine that overlaps a lot with overtraining and all these different things. Mm-hmm. Do you have any like tips or anything that you found can help differentiate between some of these overlapping, I guess, presentations?
Yeah, again, I want to credit the medical training we get to understanding the physiology behind a lot of these things and you know, the physical aspect of it. I think what I call periodization of sport, well, you know, periodization is in different sports around, you know, when they're, you know, a lot of runners do it and swimmers do it according to times of their season, when they're going to taper, when they're going to increase, those types of things, and the nutrition changes during those times. Well, I always advocate for the mental health support for athletes to also follow that periodization through the year, because their needs are going to change. The peaks and valleys of their emotional experience throughout an entire season of something, name the sport it would apply, is going to change. And that's building up for an event, and then the event itself, and then the after event. That's going to depend on their performance. And then it's going to be preparing for the next event, and team selections and deselections and weight changes and messages that are given around weight during a season and performance.
all of that is going to fluctuate. So I think it's really important to follow athletes over time to really walk that journey with them, be on that journey and support them along the way, because then you're also aware of their training schedules. And you're also going to be more aware of if they are overtraining or taking their required breaks. And then you're able to catch things like compulsive exercising and unhealthy eating habits and not sleeping enough. That relationship is really important.
Yeah, that makes sense. So rather than just having like a snapshot in time and seeing them at one point in their season, you need to know like how are they responding? Because just as you listed, there's so many like preseason, like during season, off season. And yeah, it's so much more complex than I think people realize.
It's
and
then, very complex.
You need to have specific knowledge of each sport. Like it's very in-depth.
Yes. Yes, you could never capture accurately an athlete based on a cross-sectional period of time. You could never capture enough information.
Okay. Coming back, I'd just like to ask a little bit more about that, the post-Olympic or post-major competition depression that you see. I know this is probably could be a whole conversation in itself, but what are some of the things that you advise your athletes to like to work on so that maybe this doesn't hit them quite as hard? Like, what are some of the strategies that you provide?
One thing we always key on is really just planning for it in advance because we know it's going to happen. So having something to fill that void, it is literally like you fall off a cliff. I went to the 2021 Tokyo Summer Olympic Games with the Canadian swimmers. So, you know, we focused a lot on how to prepare them for that after the fact. I wasn't prepared for the impact it was going to have on me as a practitioner after the impact. And so now we're actually focused more on, as well, preparing staff for what that's like. Because truly being in that environment or that type of setting for that period of time, because you're literally, it's like you're transported to another world or another universe for, you know, a month. And it's completely surreal. It's at the time we were cut off from the world because of the pandemic. It's just so surreal and artificial. And then you go back to your regular life suddenly. And, you know, it's beyond just the time zone adjustment. It's kind of like nobody around me right now understands anything that I was doing in the last month or what it was like. I can't talk to anybody about it because nobody's going to understand. You're with people that aren't your friends necessarily. You're doing things that you wouldn't do every day. You're away from your family. You're away from your normal life and your home. And again, then you're suddenly cut off from the sport that you've been immersed in significantly for the last number of months. It's just like you fall off a cliff. And for me, it was about a 2-week period where it was kind of like, I had to figure out, was this a good thing or was it a bad thing? And what do I say about this? How do I figure this out in my brain? And how do I adapt back to this? I can't imagine what it would be like as one of the Olympic athletes having to do that. And it's even more prolonged than that. So we say 1 to 3 months this can last for after a major games. So we really try to feel it and understand, you know, which of those athletes that are going through that are actually going to be going through another type of life transition during that time. Some consider retirement, for example, after major games, because it's a 4-year cycle for most Olympics. And after that, they plan their life. I'm going to go to med school, I'm going to law school, I'm going to get married, I'm going to have children. So it's a huge transition. So really intentionally taking the time to not just focus on performance and prep for that major games leading up to it, but actually at some point finding the time to bridge the let's just talk about what's going to come afterwards so that, you know, when it comes, no thought needs to go into it. No emotion need to go into it because you're going to be emotionally void for a very long time. You just need to then have a plan that you're going to follow so that you just have something to do every day. You have someone to fill your bucket every day because it's just going to be different.
Okay. I think that's such good advice. And I think that's something that even if someone's not a high elite level athlete, planning ahead and anticipating yes. these harder moments in life can really help with getting through them. Yeah. I would like to ask a little bit more on the eating disorders. You had mentioned the wrestler that presented with an eating disorder and the people didn't really know how to properly care for this athlete because they didn't understand the nuances of her sport or the sport, I'm not sure. I guess, like, my question would be, is your approach, like, how does your approach to an athlete with an eating disorder differ from a non-athlete with an eating disorder? Like, there must be some kind of like interplay between or like walking that line between allowing them to compete and allowing them to still exercise, but also treating a serious, serious mental illness.
This is one of the most difficult ones to approach, I think. And it's the one that takes the longest to even budge with. So I wrote a paper recently on mental health considerations for athlete removal from play and return to play. planning. And as I was doing it, it started off as more of a return to play planning, because, you know, we see it's fairly straightforward to plan for an athlete to return to play following a knee surgery or an ankle surgery. It's pretty clear, but a lot of people don't have the knowledge to know what needs to be considered to come back from a mental health episode. You know, if it's depression, if it's anxiety, if it's psychosis, if it's an eating disorder. And as I was doing the research and early stages of writing for this paper, it became clear, actually, we need guidelines about removal from play too, because sometimes athletes actually need to be removed from play in order to deal with the challenges that they're going through in order for them to be able to help respond, return in a healthy way. And eating disorders came out very prominently in my research for this, obviously. And as opposed to every other mental health condition out there, in fact, eating disorders have the clearest criteria that have been developed over the last number of years for removal from play, exclusion from play, and return to play. So I'm very, very grateful for that, because it is exceedingly difficult to walk that line, as you described it as. These athletes really want to be in their sport. It's on one side a happy place for them because it's their outlet, provides them with feedback, positive, but you know, when the illness threshold has been crossed, if they actually fulfill criteria for anorexia nervosa or severe bulimia nervosa, it's very clear exclusion criteria for sport. They need to be removed at that time because we know there are significant medical challenges, life-threatening medical challenges that can occur. So in those situations, a very comprehensive interdisciplinary team really needs to be around that athlete, including experts in eating disorders, including psychiatry, including sport meds and nutritionists, for example. But there are very clear criteria that have been written by the Norwegian Olympic Committee, the Australian Institute for Sport, and the Female Athlete Triad consensus statement from a number of years ago actually developed a tool, a screening and rating tool to guide return to play guidelines for that. So I always recommend, and I did this in my paper, you need to follow those guidelines for anybody who has an eating disorder, you know, that surpasses the threshold for illness. These absolutely need to be followed. And it makes it a bit easier because we're able to say, look, this is why, you know, we're so concerned. And here's what we need to see in order to be able to get you back. So I think it creates more of a partnership. It's less subjective. It's much more objective. We have the measurements and we have the ability to create a contract and guidelines for that.
Yeah, I can say it's a very complex situation. And I have experience within weight-based sports and cutting weight, and it's and I've seen athletes competing in MMA that go through brutal weight cuts and their weight fluctuates, and it's all they hyper focus on. And to me it's honestly surprising not more athletes come out with some of these eating disorders or disordered eating patterns, because it can be a very toxic environment that sometimes
is very pervasive, and I think it's under-recognized for sure. And we see it a lot in cycling. You know, we see it a lot in the endurance sports as well. Lighter is faster. Any anti-gravity sports, if I can lighter, I can jump higher. It's a very slippery slope. And, you know, we need the culture of sport to change a bit to help support the healthier messages that we need to give. Recently, there were new guidelines that came out around REDS, or relative energy deficiency in sport. And I was involved with the mental health paper that came out on that. But what I see in sport a lot is there's a lot of focus on underfueling as a reason for, you know, loss of power and such. And so they focus on that underfueling piece, but they really, by focusing on that, you really exclude a lot of consideration of the other things, which is the development of the disordered eating or eating disorders, or other compulsive exercising or unhealthy approaches to exercise that will derail the athlete eventually, absolutely will derail the athlete. And we need the entire team to be on the same page with messaging, or it becomes exceedingly difficult to make some changes in that athlete's approach to sport.
Yeah, it's a very challenging topic. And I'm sure, again, that could be an entire conversation in itself. I know we're just touching the surface on so many of these, but it's a fascinating area, field, and I appreciate you sharing your knowledge. Maybe we can talk about a little bit some of the nuances within prescribing psychiatric medications to athletes, because I know there's some key things that you might pay attention to in an athlete versus a non-athlete. And then by all means, I don't know if there's any other specific disorders you wanted to talk about or raise, we can do that too. But Yeah. Would you maybe share some of the things that you think about when you have identified that an athlete may benefit from, whether it's an antidepressant, anti-anxiety, anti-psychotic, or anything like this? What things that do you think about that you don't think about in a non-athlete?
Great question. And I think I'd like to take this opportunity to clear up a common myth about psychiatrists, is that people assume that all we do is prescribe medications. It's not the case whatsoever. Again, as I said a little while ago, we have a broad approach to things, and psychotherapy is often our first go-to. I mean, we need to create relationships with folks and understand the root causes for things. We don't go to the prescription pad right away, and I would say rarely. And I would say in my day, in a clinical day for me, I might prescribe to maybe 10% of people that I see. And that's, again, for those who have severe illness or need it for sure. But when we do reach the point of feeling strongly that an athlete may require medication, again, for me, it's a lot of education with them around this is why. You know, if it's borderline, if somebody has mild presentation of, you know, illness, whether it's depression, anxiety, other things that can respond fine enough to supportive psychotherapy, other types of psychotherapy or other supports, that's what we do, right? And this is a highly motivated group of people and they really want to get better and most of them do the work. It's really when they cross a threshold into more severe illness where it's really getting in the way of things, either affecting their safety, their function, or just their ability to manage on a daily basis. That's when we have these conversations and really anchoring the description into solid examples as to why, like, you know, you're not able to get to class, you're not seeing anybody, you're crying most of the time, or you're having panic attacks every day, really anchoring it into solid examples. And we as psychiatrists need to follow clinical practice guidelines or best practice guidelines, just like any physician and for any patient. So we still would follow those very same guidelines for treatment. But within those treatment opportunities, we would look at the group of medicines that are available to us, and considering special considerations that athletes would have, we would make our choices. So for example, we would like to stay away from those that are, you know, would cause weight gain, that are clearly associated with weight gain, and sedation, unless, you know, it's a beneficial side effect, a minor side effect that could be used if an athlete has insomnia. They also have anxiety. Sometimes we'll use that to our benefit, but we would tend to, you know, stay away from those if we can at first, and try the others. But still, the agents that we would choose still need to be first line or second line treatment, and we would never kind of go off label first if there are better agents that we would choose. We still have an obligation to treat the patient the best. We also have to be aware of WADA guidelines, the World Anti-Doping Association guidelines, especially for athletes who are professionals or are competing in a national or international stage. WADA releases their guidelines every year, and there are some prohibited substances that, you know, if they're needed for medical reasons, like stimulants, for example, for ADHD, there's a process to go through to legitimize, validate the diagnosis, send in the paperwork for a therapeutic use exemption form to have a certificate so they can take it during the competition. So it's really important for us to be aware of these considerations and follow those pathways. But bottom line is, like, there are some athletes, for example, there was a sprinter that I was treating with bipolar disorder. And, you know, I looking at the available medicines at the time, I tried to find the agent that would be least impactful on weight and sedation, for example. And I tried several of those agents with her, but her illness just was not responding. So eventually ended up having to go the regular pathway with the regular medications that we would use. And it worked well for her. So I think we as practitioners need to be aware of the side effects, the target symptoms, the prohibited medications, but always keep the person at the center of our focus and do what's going to be best for them. And you just have to kind of educate them best you can for informed consent and work with them to find the best outcomes.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. And I can imagine that, like, mental health is so vital to optimal performance in itself. So I can imagine in some of these cases, like, even if you're prescribing a medication that may cause a little bit of weight gain or maybe a little sedating or one of these, like, adverse side effects, if overall the athlete feels so much better and they're appropriately treated, then their performance might it might be a net gain is to what I'm trying to say.
100%. Yeah. Performance is not all about mental performance skills, but it's about mental health in general. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. If a person is not mentally well, it's going to affect their daily life, and it's going to affect their performance. So that's a part of the conversation as well.
Yeah, no, for sure. I would like to kind of just, I guess, in broad, talk a little bit about like the stigma around mental health within athletes. And you, from what you see in your experiences within your career, do you feel like mental health and mental illness is undertreated within athletes?
100%.
Okay. 100%, that's kind of what I assumed, but yeah, I was curious.
Yeah, I mean, we've made some gains in the last 10 years or so with really trying to normalize the conversation about mental health and its importance in sports settings. So, you know, teams like the Hamilton Tiger Cats have people like myself on staff who goes to training camp. You know, I have a station at their pre-participation physical, then I'm there for the team opening. You know, here's the full team that's treating you, and, you know, psychiatry is part of that, and here's what we do. So we're trying to normalize that. And, you know, by attaching performance to it, it makes it a bit easier, right? Because, you know, nobody wants to be known that they're going to see the psychiatrist, but hey, if the psychiatrist can also help with performance, then it just levels the playing field, and people aren't going to be so worried about the appearance of that, but they do worry about it. And I think athletes across the board worry about repercussions from, you know, if people know they're struggling with something, they're going to be viewed as weak or less able than the person on the bench next to them. So they're going to be not selected, or they're not going to have as many opportunities. And that it does happen. I still do see that happen. In various leagues, I've seen people traded. If anybody finds out that they're seeking help from someone from mental health. So it is a legitimate concern. So we do what we can to protect, obviously, their confidentiality. And if people in ownership or coaches in various settings ask me anything about the athlete mental health, I don't answer those questions. I tell them I can't even acknowledge that I'm seeing that person unless they have their consent. So that piece is really important. I think the establishment of confidentiality, the establishment of trust between the practitioner and the athlete so that they feel safe in you protecting their concerns and their secrets. But then when it comes to big mental health concerns around safety, the ability to be stable in travel situations or in a high pressure sport situation. Sometimes it requires conversations with the athlete to say, you know, I'm worried enough that I think we need to actually have a conversation with somebody. It doesn't happen very often, but I think the first layer of extreme trust needs to happen with the practitioner and the athlete. And then there needs to be an understanding with the sport organization, whichever one it is, that, you know, they're not going to be privy to those notes, and they're not going to be privy to all that knowledge. But it's nice to have a relationship with teams and with organizations so that, you know, a coach can come to me and say, just putting this on your radar, I don't know if you're seeing this person, but here are some things that I'm seeing that are a bit concerning to me. So I can bank that information. If I am seeing that athlete, I can weave that into my work with them. Or if I'm not seeing that athlete, I might use that as an opportunity to reach out to them. So
that makes sense. And even just with what you're saying, I can see there's so much room for like further growth of this field. And I can only hope that some of this acceptance towards like these athletes are just people too will get better. But I can imagine the fear of being traded or the fear of like having a reputation for struggling with certain things, like that is hard. And that's something that I can't imagine how much pressure that would put on an athlete. But not only are you trying to perform, but you're trying to hide certain things about yourself. It's hard.
I think even beyond that, the reproduction piece, I think there's still, you know, I spoke briefly earlier about maltreatment, you know, and there still is maltreatment if there is known that an athlete does struggle with something. They are often bullied about that by coaching staff, administration, or teammates. So the sports setting itself can be quite unsafe. So I think we still have a lot of work to do around educating every sports setting about what is appropriate. And, you know, it's mind-boggling sometimes about how some of the folks who do make those inappropriate comments just don't even understand that it's inappropriate, the words that they're saying. So we have to be explicit. You actually can't say this, this, or this. And, you know, you can get that message across in a very, very different way. But oftentimes, as we know, you know, people in different positions are primed for their approaches based on their own experience for when they were athletes. You know, it's how I was treated, so therefore I'm going to do the same thing. So we have a lot of work to do. I think we're getting better. I think there are fewer instances of that, but we still need to really make sport a safer place for people to to deal with their mental health, and in those settings, if they're better, actually might have less impact on the mental health of athletes.
Mm-hmm. And it's like so crazy, but there's certain things that are almost like accepted or allowed or just like they not given attention to when they happen within sport. But then if you took the same situation and it was in any other context, it'd be completely unacceptable. So there's still so much work that needs to be done, but
yeah, I think that's the challenge, you know, when we get the political side of sport happening, right? When we know in Canada for the last couple of years or more, there's been a really big push from a number of great advocacy groups. We see what's happened with the gymnasts and many other sports in Canada, and the calls for an inquiry and whether or not that will ever happen. It becomes so political and such a hot potato topic that it almost paralyzes the system, right? But we have a whole lot of people who are waiting for not even justice, but to be heard, you know, for validation, for and to see change. I think people just want to see change so that we know that future athletes won't have to go through the same thing.
Yeah, no, for sure. I guess to end on maybe a positive note, is there something that you're like most excited about within the field right now, or something that's like you've already shared so many exciting parts of your practice, but does anything come to mind?
There's some really cool stuff happening. Thanks for asking. This, with one of the hats that I wear as the president now of the International Society for Sports Psychiatry, which is so cool when I think about it.
That is very cool.
Right? 20 years ago, literally 20 years ago is when I first heard about this organization and became really inspired to do this. And now I'm the president. This past summer, I hosted the first ever global summit series in sports psychiatry, where we literally hosted delegates of leaders in sports psychiatry from 16 different countries, which was so amazing to hear about the systems and how it happens there. And, you know, we've created an alliance where we're trying to work with other organizations. We've got a liaison now with the World Psychiatric Association to really, I get so excited talking about this, to really move the knowledge base and the influence of, you know, even just movement medicine and lifestyle medicine to the masses, you know, and really try to improve mental health across the board for everybody, and including athletes. And we've got, you know, high performance athletes, we've got athletes who aren't high performance, and we've got people who just want to be active, and we want to improve the mental health for everybody. So we're really taking a global approach to this, and I'm really grateful to have the opportunities with the organizations that I'm working with to be able to do this. So I'm super pumped about that.
That's so exciting. And for anyone listening, I'll definitely link to some of these organizations and also some of the papers that you've written. They'll all be below in the show notes so people can just click and check things out. Because yeah, there's some really exciting things happening. I completely agree. I guess as we kind of close out here, I always like to ask my guests, like, if there's like one lasting message or one thing that you just really like people to take away from this conversation, what do you think it would be?
I guess it depends on who's listening, but if it's folks who you know, are interested in an area that inspires them and excites them, whether it's, you know, mental health and sports or whatever it is, I'm going to say, just follow it. Don't be limited by what's only available to you right now. Dream, see the gaps, you know, find your passion and follow it, and connect with the people along the way who can help you find it, because nothing is impossible. You're able to do great things. Never be limited by someone telling you that it's not possible. That's what I would say.
Thank you. I love that. I can take that message myself too. So anyone listening wants to like connect with you, learn more about you, go to your website, follow what you're doing, or is there like, where would you direct them to? Or are you on social media or any of these platforms?
I am on social media. I'm on, I guess, X now. At EdwardsTanCarla is my handle on X. That's where I spend most of my time. Or LinkedIn. I like to post a lot of cool new things on LinkedIn with new papers and such. Otherwise, if you Google search, you know, Carla Edwards Sports Psychiatry, you'll find me, my website in Canada, synergysportmentalhealth.ca. It's a long one, but that's where I hang out.
Perfect. Well, I'll link to that one below in the show notes and a few of the other links as well. And thank you so much. I'm actually so inspired. I want to learn more about this. I'll definitely be telling some of my fellow residents about it. I know a few that are in psychiatry too, so they might be very interested. And thank you for all you're doing to advance the field and for all you're doing for like athletes, not even just in Canada, but in the world. And I think like this is a very important field, and it's under-recognized. And I have learned so much, and thank you for what you're doing.
I appreciate it. I appreciate your time to talk about this and your interest in this field. And I look forward to having you as a colleague in the future.
That's all for now. Thank you for listening, and I hope it was valuable to you. Please remember to check out the show notes for all the resources mentioned and links to connect with our guest. If you would like to support what I'm doing, the best way to help me grow the show is to subscribe, of course, but also share it with your friends and family or on social media. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, you can also leave a 5-star review and or a comment. A special thank you, as always, to Tyler Gatto for composing the theme music for the podcast, and to Wyatt Pavlik for the excellent audio engineering each and every episode. So until next time, keep training hard, keep eating plants, and take care.